It's Wednesday, December 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, the top U.S. diplomat visits Moscow to discuss conflicts in Ukraine and Syria. The South Sudan conflict reaches a grim milestone.
They've called out Donald Trump on some of his positions, particularly kind of the ban on Muslims in the United States.
The controversial and popular Donald Trump is at the center of the latest Republican presidential debate. Also ahead, a silent North Korean band, and Star Wars is back. In the movie theaters, that is. It's all on today's International Edition. Tensions remain between the United States and Russia concerning ongoing conflicts in Ukraine and Syria. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has traveled to Moscow to meet with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov and President Vladimir Putin. Before the talk, Secretary Kerry said the United States and Russia have the ability to make a significant difference in Syria's crisis. He added the first two rounds of talks on a political transition in Syria are a strong beginning. Well, preparing to depart with Secretary Kerry, VOA State Department Pam Dawkins joins us from a noisy media bus to fill us in on the meetings.
Well, the U.S. and Russia appear to have bridged some of their gaps on Syria after a meeting today with Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov and President Vladimir Putin. The Secretary of State John Kerry and Lavrov had a news conference. And Kerry said that while the U.S. and Russia don't see eye to eye on every aspect of Syria, they see Syria fundamentally in similar ways. He said the U.S. and Russia see the same challenges, they see the same dangers, and want the same outcome. Lavrov said the U.S. and Russia agree to intensify counterterrorism efforts, coordinate more militarily, and continue work on listing terrorist organizations in Syria.
President Putin, through a translator, had mentioned that the United States and Russia together were looking for ways out of the most urgent crises, the unrest in Ukraine and Islamic State militants in Syria. The two countries are coming at this a little bit from different angles, as in both of those cases, Russia is seen as going into the situation. How did that play out in the talks?
Well, in particular with Ukraine, Secretary Kerry mentioned that if there's full compliance with the Minsk Agreement, which is a ceasefire, but there have been some violations of it, as well as a withdrawal of forces near the border, and the United States and EU would roll back sanctions that were imposed on Russia for its support of separatists in Syria. Also, in terms of Syria in general, in terms of Syria, the two sides agreed that they would cooperate more militarily. And they also said that on most aspects of Syria, there is agreement.
The West has criticized Russia for its involvement and the airstrikes, saying that they have not targeted Islamic State as much as they claim to have been. And was Secretary Kerry able to bridge that gap a little bit?
He did not specifically address that, but Lavrov, in his comments, did say the two sides would cooperate more militarily, perhaps down the road, perhaps that will lead to more of a targeted focus on militants. They also mentioned that there had been progress on a list to designate which militant groups in Syria were terrorist groups. This is a Jordan-led process, and they said there had been progress on that front.
On social media, I saw some pictures of Secretary Kerry walking through the streets, and he seemed to be greeted by very happy people.
Yes, it's been a busy day, but he did have a little bit of downtime. He went out briefly with the U.S. ambassador to Russia after his visit, the ambassador at his residence, and did some shopping. It was a picturesque scene. People came up and greeted Kerry. And while they were out walking down through a shopping district here in Moscow, it started to snow. It's a very ornate area. There are a lot of decorations up for the New Year. And I think it was a nice outing for both of them.
Pam Dawkins is our State Department correspondent, and I know you need to run. Pam, thank you so much for taking a little bit of time out to speak with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, we're staying in the Middle East, where the latest archaeological finding is making headlines and, of course, on its way into social media. International Edition's social media guru is G. Abby Lee. She's right here in Studio 22 to tell us more. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. Buzzing online today is a talk of the world's most famous Jew. And no, I'm not talking about Barbara Streisand. We're talking about Jesus Christ. A medical artist drew the religious figure based on forensic and anthropological research. And you can find links to a number of articles on this story. But for our segment, let's go to a link provided by the Esquire magazine's Twitter account, at Esquire. Richard Nee from England drew a picture of what he thinks Jesus would have looked like with the help of British scientists and Israeli archaeologists.
Well, what kind of experience does Nee have?
Well, this is not his first stint at recreating historical figures. He has reconstructed dozens of famous faces in the past two decades, including Philip II of Macedonia and the father of Alexander the Great.
Well, I'm sure he has a method. Tell us what the process was.
Sure. So Neve and his team derived from the Bible that Jesus had typical features of his countrymen at that time. So the team acquired three skulls from Jerusalem to figure out the bone structure. As for his hair and coloration, they turned to drawings dating back to the first century. So these drawings were done before the Bible was compiled, and the team concluded Jesus had dark eyes and short curly hair, and keeping with Jewish tradition, probably a full beard. And I'm not sure about our listeners in Africa, but people who grew up in the West and Asia are more familiar with a much different image of Jesus.
Definitely. Well, we're more used to Jesus that has long flowing hair and some lighter features, the Caucasian version, you might
say. Exactly. But if you think about it scientifically, Jim, it's not that big of a surprise because let's read from one comment from the Epic Times on Facebook. Three skulls later, and we have Jesus. I'm impressed, and seemingly he wasn't white as well. Now I am shocked. Whoever thought someone born to non-white parents and living 2,000 years ago in the Middle East would be white? That sarcastic reply got more than 100 likes. And many news articles are hailing this latest image as the most accurate depiction of Jesus to date. Back to you.
Well, thanks as always for bringing us What's Buzzing Online. You can follow G on her Twitter account, at G Abby Lee, and also on our program's account, at VOA underscore IE. I'm out there as well, at VOA Stevenson. This is VOA.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar at voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Despite an August peace plan and the presence of thousands of UN peacekeepers, South Sudan's conflict, as of Tuesday, has entered its second year with tens of thousands killed and more than 2 million displaced. Nearly 4 million are considered food insecure. Leslie Lefko is the Deputy Africa Director for Human Rights Watch, and speaking to VOA's Victor Beatty from Amsterdam, she says, tragically, there has been little in the way of implementation of the August 26th peace agreement.
We see continuing attacks on civilians in certain areas of the country. We've seen very little progress, if any, on accountability and justice. The larger problem of violence and impunity in this country remains a massive challenge.
Is this an international responsibility and breakdown in responsibility, or is this a governmental problem?
Well, I think first and foremost, the responsibility lies with the individual leaders in South Sudan who have created this crisis, who have prolonged this crisis, and who continue to to fail to take the steps that are necessary to protect civilians, to protect their own people, and to stop this horrific violence. But the international community also bears responsibility. South Sudan's partners, I think, bear a serious portion of responsibility for failing to stress that South Sudan's leadership needed to put protection and promotion of human rights at the forefront of their agenda for years, well before this conflict started.
There have been numerous promises for a ceasefire and a truce and an end to the conflict. Nothing seems to happen. Why?
There's a long-standing cycle of leaders in South Sudan basically being rewarded for their violence and, you know, being rewarded either monetarily or with political positions without, you know, very few conditions. And I think this is a longstanding problem. There's also been, you know, very few consequences in the past, including in the long civil war that gave birth to South Sudan. There's been very few consequences for the kind of crimes that we've seen in the last 2 years, but also seen in the past by many of these same commanders who are involved today. So I think there's a sense that that crime actually does pay.
Human Rights Watch on Tuesday issued a new 65-page report based on interviews that denounces the continued widespread use of child soldiers by both rebels and the government. The UN Children's Fund estimates up to 16,000 children may have been used during the two-year-old conflict. Republican presidential hopefuls here in the United States are making final preparations for their fifth debate. This time it's in Las Vegas, Nevada. International Edition host Susan Yockey finds out the latest from Josh Hawley. He's a former senior advisor to the House Armed Services Committee and also a staffer for former House Speaker Republican John Boehner.
Now, we've been seeing them rise for quite a few weeks now, and I think tonight should be an interesting show, to say the least. I think one of the clear takeaways here is that there's a dissatisfaction with the president at the moment, how he's handling national security, and specifically that he likely hasn't done enough to fight ISIS. And there's a real unease there, and I think that Mr. Trump he's tapped into that unease, and he appears to be riding that wave. The question is, how will this evening kind of play out? Will he continue to ride the wave, or will some of these policies that are proposed that might be difficult to work and might be unworkable, will there be the crescendo of that wave and become crashing down as we head into Iowa in January? I think that's one of the big questions still that's hanging out there.
Some of the candidates that are going to be speaking tonight have spoken out against Trump and his policy about Islam.
Yes, and I think you'll see that. I think that's been one of the things that a lot of the candidates, particularly, you know, Governor Bush, Senator Rubio, Senator Cruz, how are they going to differentiate themselves with Donald Trump on some of these issues that resonate so well with the Republican base? I think it's going to be a tricky one, but they've also they've called out Donald Trump on some of his positions, particularly kind of the ban on Muslims in the United States, as being un-American, not being what the foundation is for the country, and unworkable as well, because you're not going to have that litmus test.
Well, Texas Senator Ted Cruz has been doing pretty well in polls lately. What do you think of him?
I think he will. He's also resonating because I think he taps into that same energy that Donald Trump is at the moment. He also seems to have kind of the conservative base, and you've seen his rise in Iowa. And I think it'll be interesting kind of how can he, you know, the position that he has in the Senate, the position he has on the Senate Armed Services Committee, it really kind of gives him a platform to address some of these issues and really kind of have a seat at the policymaking table. So I'm looking forward to seeing how he continues to translate that into support in some of these key states. And whether or not, you know, as the attention now focuses on him, you know, you've seen Donald Trump come after him pretty aggressively in the last few days. So does that now begin to kind of mute some of his support, or does his support continue to rise? Because now you've seen some of the conservative talk radio hosts as well kind of rally around Ted Cruz and kind of push back against Trump. And both of them were kind of running as an anti-establishment campaign. So it'll be interesting to see if there's enough room for both of them kind of as we get further into the campaign and as people actually start voting.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
North Korea's all-girl pop band, Moranbong, abruptly canceled its friendship tour of China before playing even one gig. The band was in China to play three dates, their first foreign dates ever, but flew back to Pyongyang hours before it was set to take the stage for its first show. Said to have been handpicked by North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, the band is reported to be popular in its home country and is also known to wear relatively risque outfits along with trendy hairstyles. The band plays a mix of Western and traditional Korean songs, and here's a sampling of Moranbong's music. It's the theme to the movie Rocky that you may find on YouTube. Check it out. They're fun to watch. Neither China nor North Korea, though, has commented as to why the tour was canceled. But on Friday, the band held a practice at Beijing's National Center for the Performing Arts, and then the next day it showed up at Beijing's airport, not to play, but to fly back to North Korea. Relations between North Korea and China have been historically close, but as of late, they've been a bit rocky, you might say, with Beijing having condemned Pyongyang's nuclear bomb tests in 2013. The latest installment in the Star Wars saga, Star Wars: The Force Awakens, opened Monday in Los Angeles. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the long-awaited film is living up to the anticipation, and it offers fans a new story for a new generation.
A who's who of Hollywood turned out for the premiere in Los Angeles Monday night. Star Wars: The Force Awakens takes up the story 30 years after the end of The Return of the Jedi. The galaxy is still at war between the forces of the First Order, an offshoot of the old Galactic Empire, and the Resistance, the next generation of the old Rebel Alliance. The film features many of the heroes from the saga, including Han Solo, Leia Organa, Chewbacca, R2-D2, and C-3PO. Anthony Daniels, who plays the protocol droid C-3PO, said Monday that director J.J. Abrams has produced a film that a new generation of fans will fall in love with.
Because the care and attention, the love, the detail, everything, the enthusiasm, the excitement that J.J. and the whole team brought to it, and the cast, it's being echoed tonight.
Harrison Ford reprises his role as smuggler and rebel fighter Han Solo. He said it was great to be back in the old role.
You know, people have been anticipating this film for a long time, and that's a good thing. And we had a really good script, and J.J. is a director that I really admire and have for a long, long time. I was pleased to be back.
Adam Driver plays the new villain in the series, Kylo Ren, who has sworn to take revenge on the rebels for destroying the Empire. Driver says the magnitude of his role didn't hit him until he got on set.
It really didn't hit me, actually, until I walked into this guy's office, who's Michael Kaplan, who did the costumes for it, and I saw everybody's drawing on the wall, and that was the first time that it really hit me. And oh, it's a Star Wars movie.
John Boyega plays Finn, a stormtrooper who finds his loyalties divided between the First Order and the Resistance. Boyega says that being part of the iconic series is mind-boggling.
Yeah, I feel great. I feel fantastic, and I feel surprisingly relaxed. I mean, this is an environment that I feel like
is loving enough. I'm a Star Wars fan, so I feel like we're paying homage to a film that I really respect. So I feel good.
Star Wars The Force Awakens also stars Oscar winner Lupita Nyong'o. Daisy Ridley plays Rai, a scavenger who gets drawn into the conflict. Mark Hamill reprises his role of Luke Skywalker, the Jedi Master. And Carrie Fisher returns as Leia. Game of Thrones star Gwendolyn Christie stars as Captain Phasma, the first female stormtrooper.
I just feel like Lucasfilm and Disney have listened to what people want. And in being more diverse with the casting choices and creating characters like Captain Phasma, I think they've really listened to what it is people want to see on their screens.
Star Wars The Force Awakens opens in wide release in the United States Friday. It is the first of four new Star Wars movies due out by 2019. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
That David Byrd, the force is definitely strong with him, as it is with our director Tracy Carter and our engineer Aydin Utku. You can find our program on our website at voanews.com, where the force is with you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We're also out there on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a great day and look forward to the time when we can get back together again. How about tomorrow? Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
2015 has been a transformative year in U.S.-India relations, said United States Ambassador to India Richard Verma. In remarks to the Brookings Institute in Washington, Ambassador Verma reviewed U.S.-India cooperation in three important areas: defense and strategic ties, economics and trade, and climate change. 2015 was a year of many firsts in our security partnership with India, Ambassador Verma noted. Significant milestones in security cooperation include the Defense Technology and Trade Initiative, or DTTI, further integrating U.S. and Indian defense industries, bilateral defense trade that has reached nearly $14 billion, with billions more in the pipeline, and an agreement on a common vision for the security of the Asia-Pacific. The increase in U.S.-India economic cooperation is impressive, said Ambassador Verma. In 2005, our two-way trade numbers were around $30 billion. Today, they stand at $104 billion, and we are aiming to get that number up to $500 billion in the near future. Cumulative Indian foreign direct investment in the United States totaled $7.8 billion in 2014. U.S. foreign direct investment into India was $28 billion. No global challenge will have a more profound impact on future generations than the issue of climate change, the U.S. ambassador warned. To meet that challenge, President Barack Obama and Prime Minister Narendra Modi held a constructive meeting during the recent Paris Climate Conference and announced that the United States, India, and 18 other nations are seeking to double their investment in clean energy research and development over 5 years. This initiative, called Mission Innovation, seeks to ensure continued improvements in energy technology decades down the road. And at the same time, 28 billionaires launched a private sector component of Mission Innovation to invest substantial private capital in early-stage technology development in participating countries. These clean energy efforts, Ambassador Verma noted, build on the already substantial work effort at the mission to strongly support India's move to a renewable future and help reach its 175 gigawatt target for renewables, the world's highest such target. Ambassador Verma said the U.S. will continue to work with India to ensure that the relationship continues to be strong and successful in the 21st century.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.